It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's a big week for the humanities in Pittsburgh as some of the best-known names in art, literature, and history arrive for the Pittsburgh Humanities Festival, subtitled Smart Talk About Stuff That Matters. 4 days of presentations and talks, including the likes of George Takei, who played Sulu on Star Trek, to poet Terrence Hayes. In all, there are some 18 sessions within or near the Cultural Center. The festival is the brainchild of David Shumway, professor of literacy and cultural studies and director of the Humanities Center at Carnegie Mellon University. He joins us now in Studio A. David Shumway, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, thanks for having me. Wonderful to be here.
You can join our conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. We'd like to hear from you. What are some of the things that you're looking forward to seeing at the Humanities Festival? How should we think differently about the humanities? And what are your thoughts about how this festival might foster that? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. David Shumway, where did this idea come from?
Well, I had known about the Chicago Humanities Festival for some time. I was a visitor at the University of Chicago back in the 90s, and at that point, the Chicago Festival had already been going for about 10 years, but it was still a fairly small operation. I didn't actually get to witness it then, but it put the germ in my mind, and more recently, maybe about 2010 or 11, I learned a good deal more about it, and it seemed to me that this was the kind of event that would really fit well into Pittsburgh today, a Pittsburgh that's built around jobs in higher education and healthcare and the high-tech industry. Demographics are changing here, and this festival is really both designed to interest people who are part of those worlds, not just them, but certainly them, but also in a way to encourage this kind of change in the city, to celebrate our movement into the 21st century.
And, you know, coming from a place like Chicago, it's a big city, and certainly you could see where that vast population could support something like this. Is Pittsburgh big enough to support a humanities festival?
Oh, I think so. The Chicago Festival is considerably bigger. So we're not trying to do anything on the scale that that they do. Their festival runs 2 weeks, probably has 60 or 70 presenters. We're doing one weekend and, as you say, about 18 events, slightly more than that, but it's a much smaller thing. And we're not, in general, looking for huge crowds. The rooms where most of the events will take place seat about 100 people. So we don't need to attract, Woodstock-sized crowds to make it a success.
You say that you wanted to find a new way of thinking about an age-old discipline that encompasses art and philosophy, history, literature, et cetera. What do you mean by that? What is the new way of thinking?
So the humanities actually, although they have roots that go back that far, are relatively new. They really come out of the 18th century, the creation of the research university, like all of the other academic disciplines. But most people tend to think of the humanities primarily as something that goes on in the university, and that's what I mean by a new way of thinking about it is I want people to help to realize that, in fact, most people who read or visit museums or go to concerts or performances are participating in the humanities without knowing it. The humanities are vital to the arts and, I would argue, to civic life. And it's this second issue, which is the subject of Azar Nafisi's talk. Azar Nafisi is starting off the festival on Thursday evening at the Bayam Theater. And she's the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, which was a bestseller. Of course, it's a book about teaching literature discussing literature really with students in a climate where what she was doing was illegal. It was resisting the Islamic State. And people were inspired by that book. Her new book, which she's going to be talking from in Pittsburgh, deals with the importance of reading literature in the United States. And she regards fiction, novels, as extremely important to maintaining our democracy. So this is I think, a vital point, and she's a wonderful speaker. I think everybody who hears that talk will be inspired.
That's just one of the presentations that will be taking place at the Pittsburgh Humanities Festival. It starts Thursday and goes through Sunday night. The climactic event is the appearance of George Takei, who, of course, played Sulu on Star Trek, talking about a number of things, including his time in a Japanese-American internment camp and also his advocacy for gay rights. He came out a few years ago, and he has traveled to Pittsburgh with his partner in the past, and I imagine he will be with on Sunday night. So it'll be interesting to see George Takei, Terrence Hayes, John Sayles talking about independent film, and you'll be moderating that discussion. David Shumway, who, by the way, is our guest, professor of literacy and cultural studies at CMU. Talk about this discussion with John Sayles, who is a well-known independent filmmaker, wrote the screenplays for films like Eight Men Out, City of Hope. This is a particularly interesting time to have this discussion because of the state of things for independent filmmakers. Talk about this.
Well, so John Sayles is often called the godfather or sometimes the grandfather of independent film. Back in 1980, he directed, wrote, and edited a film called Return of the Secaucus 7. And he made that film for roughly $60,000, and it returned $2 million. So it started off. It made the industry realize that you could make money from films that you didn't have to invest a lot in. And as a result of that, a whole new way of making movies developed, and lots of important films came out of that movement, some of them by John Sayles, like Mate One and Lone Star. Others, like Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Pulp Fiction, developed out of that movement. But in recent years, the distributors who used to pick up these movies made outside the studio system have either closed their doors or they've become much more restrictive. They think it's harder and harder to sell movies that aren't about superheroes or that don't have big stars in them. And the independents have always had to rely on casts that, well, not always, but usually not so well known. And so that's one of the things I want to talk to John Sayles about, who knows this history probably better than anybody in the country since he's lived it.
And do we know, you mentioned that distributors now are concerned that if you don't have some sort of, blockbuster story or a huge star in the film that you can't sell it. I mean, they used to be able to sell these films, and you pointed out the Return of the Secaucus 7 as an example of how the independent film could make money. What are they seeing? What is telling them that this is not possible, and why isn't a good story enough anymore?
Well, I think it's very complicated. A lot of it has to do with the fact that as people's attention is diverted increasingly by more and more different kinds of screens, it's harder and harder to get people into the multiplexes. It's been true for a long time that the target audience for mainstream Hollywood movies is 14-year-old boys. And so movies are aimed at adolescents. And these are the most reliable audiences. And that's partly why Hollywood follows them. There's also the question of predictability. So sequels are so important to Hollywood because they believe that a sequel is more likely to be counted on to return a profit, whereas an independent film is somewhat less likely because it doesn't have a track record. It doesn't have anything behind it in their view. And so the industry is becoming less and less risk-averse, or more and more risk-averse. They're more averse to risk and wanting trying to make movie production more a sure thing, which, of course, it's never been.
And so this will be just one of the discussions that will be taking place at the Humanities Festival here in Pittsburgh starting on Thursday. And I want to go back to the, you know, talking about, you know, taking the humanities out of the ivory tower, out of the intellectual holding cell, if you will. You've decided to hold this event not on a college campus but at downtown venues. Explain the thinking behind that and how that will achieve this.
Well, so faculty and students on college campuses have more access to the humanities, of course, than most people. The classes are available. There are fairly frequent lectures and discussions. So we wanted to make this available to people who aren't regularly on college campuses, and we thought that people would be perhaps more comfortable not having to come to a college campus and sit in a classroom in order to experience these talks and presentations, which are, by the way, not going to be lectures. They're going to be lively, short presentations or interviews, and there will be a chance for audience involvement in every one of them, time for discussion. So we believe that each of these presentations is going to be not only interesting and informative, but entertaining.
And as far as what you want to do in the future with this, this is year one. So what will you look at when you tally up the results, assess how it went, and how will that inform your decisions going forward as far as expanding this festival or making it an annual event?
Well, the plan is to make it an annual event, and we'll be looking for comments and suggestions based on the talks that we do have. Of course, attendance will be a factor, how many people turn out for this. We hope we get a good turnout. I'm not sure that low attendance would necessarily mean we wouldn't do it again, but high attendance would pretty much guarantee that we would. You know, we'll assess how well we think the presentations got across new ideas and how successful they were in achieving our goal of bringing interesting, thought-provoking experiences to Pittsburgh.
And what do you want people ultimately to take away from this? And then it's a variety of different presentations, but if somebody attends, say, more than one or on more than one day, what is the feeling that you would like people to come away with?
We want them to feel, really stimulated, really, wow, that was really interesting. I never thought about those things before. That these are, you know, I couldn't have imagined those ideas. We hope people will really be exposed to new things that will make them feel excited about ideas about the world they live in.
David Shumway has been our guest. He's professor of literacy and cultural studies and director of the Humanities Center at Carnegie Mellon University. And the Pittsburgh Humanities Festival is his brainchild. It gets underway on Thursday and runs through Sunday night. David Shumway, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul.
Coming up, the story behind Words Without Walls, encouraging prison inmates to write. It's a Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Words Without Walls is a program at Chatham University that teaches creative writing to residents of Pittsburgh area correctional facilities and drug treatment centers. These classes, which are taught by students in Chatham's MFA program in creative writing, are intended to help inmates and people dealing with addiction to reflect on their experiences and express themselves through poetry and prose. This Friday on the Chatham campus, the program will celebrate the launch of its book, Words Without Walls, Writers on Addiction, Violence, and Incarceration, a collection of some of the best writing by the Words Without Walls students. Joining us to talk about the project are MFA program director and author Cheryl St. Germain and Johnny Blevins, a student and instructor in the program. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Would you tell us how Words Without Walls started?
Sure. About 8 years ago, we began to follow Sandra Gould Ford, who was teaching in the Allegheny County Jail. She was doing creative writing classes. She wanted to leave, and we wanted to start a program there. And so after following her for, a year, maybe half a year, we began our own program there in the jail. We became so successful that we expanded to three classes, and then we expanded to the prison, SCI Pittsburgh, and expanded to Sojourner House, which is a rehab facility for women with children. And it was not just the idea that we thought we could help people tell their own stories and that would heal. Obviously, that was really important, but it was also important for me as a director to get students from our program working with alternative populations. MFA programs are too often programs all about yourself, about being selfish, about being published. So it's a way of getting students to interact with members of the community.
And so what's it like when you approach, and I'm guessing there's some direct contact here with these inmates. So what's it like when you approach them and say, hey, I've got this idea. You can write. You can express yourself. You can use it as some sort of cathartic thing to better yourself and improve your outlook, perhaps. What is the reaction that you get from these folks?
It's generally very positive. I mean, exactly what you said. Who would not want to use their time, to grow? And a lot of people at the prison say that it's either a learning cathedral or a fool's paradise. So the students that we get who volunteer to come in and take classes from us are usually already interested, and they're curious about how, to better. Even if they are interested in becoming better professional writers, they learn how to write better letters. And that's something that's invaluable to almost anyone, is being able to communicate in a way you've never been able to before.
And what is the level of writing that you encounter with? I imagine it probably runs the gamut.
Yeah. I mean, it's all over the place. Sometimes my favorite writers are from, the prison and the jail, because they've got some great lines. One student said, we watch birds because we want to remember what it's like before they had their wings ripped away. So it's just lines like that that make you, bristle.
You would be surprised at the level of writing. A couple of our students have won the national award that Penn offers for prison writing. And although this book is actually contemporary published writers primarily, the book that's coming out Friday, we did include about three pieces that are from the prison and the jail and the rehab facility, just astonishing work. But, we think it's valuable for them to be able to tell stories, and most of them have stories to tell. And it reminds us of why most of us became writers to begin with, to go to that elemental place where you have a story to tell and it helps you to put it on paper.
A lot of times you'll hear teachers talk about students who don't like writing. It's not always popular with people, particularly younger people. And what they'll say is, I don't know what to write about. I'm guessing you don't get that much from these people who are in prison, that they have stories to tell.
They do, and they want to tell them. And the women, for example, in Sojourner House tell us every week this is their favorite class. They can't wait to get to it. Because we really and truly, and the jail as well, and as well as the prison, we care about their stories. We don't treat them like inmates or addicts or drunks. We treat them as writers. And so we rejoice with them when they're able to tell a story that's really difficult to tell.
And what's it like when you have to tell them that that their writing isn't particularly good?
It just depends. We tell them that we're here and this is a trust nest and this is just out of love, you know, because if you want to write really well, you know, it's something that you have to say. And we teach about revision and things like this. And we usually have students in the class who say, hey, man, this is just, you know, I'm just doing this because I love you, you know, that kind of thing, which is really an amazing thing to see. When
we can't do this in the prison, but in the jail and in the rehab facility, when the students get out of the jail, we actually have a reading, a public reading for them. And we do it every semester with the women in Sojourner House as well. And so one of the ways we get them to work on revision is we tell them, you know, if you get this just right, you'll be able to read it in front of a public audience. And maybe we'll even publish it. So we'll show them some pieces we've managed to publish of women who have been in the facility before, the jail, and that inspires them. It's true, as Johnny says, some of them are more interested in just getting it out, but we want to help them learn how to revise.
And was the process of coordinating this project, was it difficult to coordinate it? I mean, I can imagine that there were probably concerns regarding legal issues, safety, et cetera.
Yeah.
Access, you know, that can't always be easy.
Yeah. We do have a program coordinator, Sarah Shotland, who is extremely important for this program, and she organizes a lot of that, organizes the teachers and getting them in and out of the jails. But we have a system now. We have to get permission, obviously, and we have someone who's our point person in the jail and the prison and the rehab facility. And then we always go in teams of two. The students go in teams of two, and there's one of those is a second. It's at least their second time doing it, and the first, so that we never have anyone going in there who's without someone who's going to help them.
Johnny, you're an instructor in the program. When you first started, what were you expecting?
I had worked in this kind of community before. A woman named Katie Ryan started the Appalachian Prison Book Project. And for about, 6 or 7 years, I had mailed books to prisoners across Appalachia. I was used to it. I mean, I just expected people. Sarah Shotland actually taught my first class with me, and she was very supportive, showed me everything that they did. Jack Pischke at the jail was very kind, and it just felt like I was welcome, you know?
Were there things that were surprising to you? Was that surprising to you, the fact that you were welcome?
Yes. one of the surprising things is how quarantined everybody seems to be. I didn't expect. They try to keep men and women very separate. You know, if a woman is on the floor, they have to make all the men go back to their pods and vice versa. So that's something that really surprised me, is that, you know, communication between the two is, you know, something that they want to avoid.
We're talking about the Words Without Walls program. It's a writing program for inmates, and it is overseen by – it is taught by students in Chatham's MFA program in creative writing, and it is a program overseen by Chatham University that teaches creative writing to residents of Pittsburgh area correctional facilities and drug treatment centers. If you have a comment or question – for our guests, the MFA program director and author Cheryl St. Germain and Johnny Blevins, who is a student and instructor in the program, you can call us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. And on Twitter at esspgh. What questions do you have about this program? And maybe you're someone that had a chance to either teach in it or on the teaching end, be the recipient of the advice. And we'd love to hear a story about how it helped you endure your time being incarcerated. And if you're on the outside now, how did it help you make you a better person and help you forge your way in life after being incarcerated? How would you this is something that invites, a very specific answer, because it would be easy to generalize, and we all have sort of our stereotypes about what a prison inmate must be like if we haven't been in prison. And I, for one, have never been incarcerated, fortunately. So I hear the stories, but I don't know what it's like on the inside. What are these students like who are enrolled in Words Without Walls?
They are often very much like your sisters and brothers or children. I unfortunately, both my brother and my son were in prison at some point. And
both
at different times of their lives were. So I have been on the side of a mother visiting a son in jail or a brother in prison.
So I'm imagining that those experiences must have
informed
you greatly, though,
yes,
about how to approach this.
And the thing is, my brother was in prison about 20 years ago, and all he learned he was 18. He was in prison for a year, and they taught him how to make things with ice cream sticks. That was all that he learned. And he came out, but he wrote me these incredible letters when he was in prison. And I thought, who knew my brother, who was always in trouble at school, could write? And that's, I think about my brother, and I also think about my son a lot when I'm teaching these folks in jail, because I wish that my brother had had someone to help him learn how to write. And often when people go to jail, it's a transient place. And so there's not as often as many programs there as for people who are in prison, because they're moving them in and moving them out. And I think we're filling a real niche there for people who are maybe there for a few months. Some of them are a bit longer. Johnny, you probably have thoughts about this as well.
Definitely. We have it's a lot like a high school class. We have every single archetype that you would expect. Like, for instance, there's the one who loves the laudation poem, which is a brag poem, and I'm the best and blah, 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 you know. And then it's nice to see them sort of come around. And there's the shy person who doesn't want to speak in class, but they're writing the most phenomenal prophetic, you know, thing, and they don't want to speak up. You know, just your regular kind of people with
I'm guessing that you encounter a lot of anger.
Yeah, at times, for sure. It's sometimes I wonder if people are too afraid even to speak to us about what they're really angry about, you know, because there's a lot to be, you know, frustrated with. One thing that's clear is that at the ACJ, you know, there's a maximum that they can stay there for 2 years before they either go upstate or are released, and they don't see the sky for, you know, that amount of time unless they go to a hearing or something, so.
Do your experiences and maybe some of what comes out in the writing, does it tell you about – does it bring up anything that you might think about in terms of how prisons may or may not need to be reformed?
Of course. I mean, that's something that I grew up on. I talk to Cheryl about this a lot, and I'm, you know, somebody who's really interested in social justice. So we end up traveling and meeting, go to education justice symposiums and things like that, and we talk about it. And I like to share with them, you know, what I've learned. And I mean, it's really frustrating sometimes because you think, you know, this is never going to get solved, but we want to make it the best that it can be while we're here, you know, because we might not change and reform, but we can at least make it a more, you know, endurable experience.
One of the things we think about a lot, and we've had a writer come and talk to us about this. Imagine that you take the very worst thing you ever did in your life, very, very worst thing, and you imagine that you get put in jail for that, and that is all you are ever remembered for, even though you get out of the jail. A lot of colleges and companies that hire people have a box that they have to check that says if you've ever been arrested, you've ever been.
Well, and there's a whole movement to ban the box.
Ban the box, and a lot of Pittsburgh has done this, you know. But it is there was a recent article in the New York Times that said that most people who are trying to go to college who were once in jail or prison or had any kind of arrest, if they see that box, they don't finish the application, most of them. And so it's the thing that strikes me is that we just keep punishing these people. You know, even when they get out, they can't leave that mistake behind.
It can prevent them from being able to vote. From getting a job.
Yes.
412-246-2002, the number to call to join our conversation with Cheryl St. Germain and Johnny Blevins, who are involved with the Words Without Walls program. Let's go to Celeste in Pittsburgh, who's been waiting on the line. Celeste, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Really enjoying the show. I'm driving right now, and I work with people teaching them to write. And I'm just wondering, are these opportunities, is there a workshop opportunity available anywhere in the Pittsburgh area that I could send people to?
Yes, there is. We have a program called Voice Catch, which is a community workshop. It's on Saturdays.
At 10 a.m. at the East Liberty Library. I teach the class along with Stephanie Vega and Johnny Caputo, and we would love to meet you.
And we built this workshop specifically to capture people who had been studying creative writing in jail or in the rehab facility once they got out. But we've opened it up to the community. So every Saturday we're there. I'm not there, but Johnny's there. And
yeah, we'd love to see you, Celeste.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. We will be there.
Awesome.
Thank you for the call, Celeste. 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Given the writer's experiences, people might assume that their work is a little dark. Is that the case?
Not always, but you know, it's certainly true that we try to get them to explore some of that darkness. In Sojourner House, almost all of the women will write about near-death experiences. Almost all of them have been pregnant while addicted and given birth to children who are addicted, and they have their children with them at Sojourner House. So they'll write about their children. But they are working very hard on recovery, too, so we try to help them to move that in a different way. The people in the jail don't tend to write so much about what got them in the jail. They might tell you. Is that right, Johnny?
Yes, that's
been my experience.
It's really interesting because a lot of people find their spiritual side there, you know, and they're always talking about rejoicing and love and, you know, that kind of thing and how they can better themselves. And, you know, I think every writer is sort of brooding and angry, you know, on some levels because that's the nature of it. It's sort of a narrative therapy that you go through.
For the MFA students who teach these courses, and you are one, Johnny, what would you say that they get out of this experience? What do you get out of it?
I'm really lucky to have gotten the Mansell Fellowship from Laurie Mansell, and I've learned how to manage a group, and I think I've done it, you know, with Sarah's help, just helped people feel more aware when they go to these places and meet incarcerated individuals, and I think we all learn maybe more than what the people at the jail and prison and halfway house and library do, because, you know, we find little families. You know, for instance, I've started hanging out with these people who are taking Osher classes from Carnegie Mellon. They attend Voice Catch on the Saturday morning weekends, and we hang out, and they teach me about, you know, this old way of living. Like, I'll meet you at 7 o'clock sharp, and there's no cell phone to say I can't come or anything, you know, because you just have to show up because there's only landlines, you know, and that sort of thing. It's really just like changed me as a person.
I have found that the students who go into these programs come out transformed and so many different ways. And some of them become alums and they go off and start their own programs. We have someone who started a program in the parish prison in New Orleans and one in North Carolina. And some of them come back and teach for us on the volunteer basis. And they often tell us that this was the most meaningful thing that they did in their entire time during the MFA program. Mm.
412-246-2002. Let's go to Tina in Pittsburgh. Tina, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. I wanted to say, one, that I think this program is absolutely wonderful and needed. I had the opportunity in the 70s to work in Hawaiian prisons and working with the incarcerated. It was a male population, and they did write, but mainly it was to then act and turn it into theater kinds of things, although completely led by them and, you know, directed and, you know, edited and such, but the content was theirs. And it was empowering for them. And I think it's a really positive experience. And I'm glad you're giving these prisoners a chance to express themselves and to let them know their story matters.
Well, we appreciate that, Tina. And did you have a question also?
I do. One, do you take volunteers?
Of course we do. Of course we do. Yeah. If you're interested,
yes, Tina.
You can go to our website. We do all kinds. Not only do we go into the jails and the prisons, but we also publish a small collection every semester of the inmates' work. And we often need people to help edit, design, things like that. So there's all kinds of, you know, we need people to help fundraise. So there's all kinds of things that people can do outside of going inside of these places.
And the website, okay, of course, great. Is wordswithoutwalls.com, just in case.
And we'll put a link to all of this at our website, WESA.FM. Tina, thank you for the call. One last thing I wanted to ask you about, and we can take other calls at 412-246-2002, but of course, and I mentioned this in the introduction, about the book, the launch of the book Words Without Walls, Writers on Addiction, Violence, and Incarceration, which is a collection of some of the best writing by the Words Without Walls students. Tell us about this. I guess the launch is taking place on Friday, later this week?
Right, Friday at 7 p.m., Chatham University, Mellon Boardroom. And this is a collection that Sarah Shotlin and I co-edited. And what it is, throughout the years we've been doing this program, we've tried to find the best writing, poems, works of fiction, nonfiction, plays, to inspire our writers. And so we've pulled really well-known writers, works from people like Jimmy Santiago Baca, for example, Toy Derricott, Joyce Carol Oates. So we have major American writers in here who have written about violence, incarceration, and addiction. But we also have some of the best writing from some of our students. For example, Eric Boyd is going to be reading on Friday, and his book, his story, actually was one of the winners of the Penn Writing Awards. So Toy Derricott will be reading.
I just picked up the book and I'm looking at the page where his story begins. When my father was beating me, probably tells a lot about how Toy ended up in prison.
Yes.
Let's take another call from Byron in Pittsburgh. Byron, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. I thank you for having me on your show.
You are welcome. Go ahead.
I just want to say really fast, I'm an over-the-road truck driver at this current time, but I was incarcerated in Arizona Corrections, and they had a program similar to yours that they invited prisoners that were on the complex of Arizona. It was a fresher breath air for us. We went in there. We spoke what our mind was on our mind, troubles we've been through. They provided writing. And, you know, continue your fight, because I've been out of prison since 2008. I'm a convicted felon. I'm a business owner now. And without something like that there, it would have been very hard to get through that time. So I thank you very much for what you're doing to continue your fight.
Thank you,
Byron.
So much.
Thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That tells us a lot of what we need to know right there.
Yeah.
Well, what a great note to end on. I don't know how we can improve upon that, but continued success with your work. Thanks to both of our guests, Cheryl St. Germain, who is MFA Program Director and an author. She is one of those involved with the Chatham University program that teaches writing to residents of Pittsburgh area correctional facilities and drug treatment centers. And it is called Words Without Walls. The book, including the best works from that program, Words Without Walls, Writers on Addiction, Violence, and Incarceration, comes out later this week. Again, Cheryl St. Germain, thank you for joining us. And also Johnny Blevins, who is a student and instructor in the program. Thanks, both of you, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, we will talk about the business generated by babies with contributor Rebecca Harris. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. After a long, cold winter, it might not be surprising to see an increase in the birth rate later this year. With those babies comes a need for products and services, and this week, contributor Rebecca Harris, director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, looks at the business of babies. Rebecca, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh. How are you?
I'm great, Paul, and there's lots of babies. There's baby puppies. There's baby rabbits. There's babies. It's the season for babies, Paul. You are speechless. I think you are.
I don't really know what is there to add to that.
Not much.
You have firsthand experience with this.
Yes,
and
yes.
Not, that doesn't mean that I'm calling you a baby, but you're
right.
A mother.
Yeah,
you've gone through the experience of bringing up babies and having to find the things that you needed.
We are big consumers. Once you become a parent, you consume, and you consume more things than you ever realize, and it truly, really is, Paul, a big business.
Okay, and I guess you wanted to start this with some numbers. You always want to go to those numbers.
I have to give people the numbers to set some context. So first of all, there are a lot of babies born in the summer, Paul. You're right. August is the most popular month for babies being born.
In fact, that's when I was born.
There you go.
What do you know?
Last year.
Hadn't really thought about it until you mentioned that.
Yeah, it makes sense. 387,000 babies were born during the month of August last year. July and September follow August as the most popular
months. My brother was July.
There you go.
Oh,
and
boy.
Then February is the least popular month for babies being born. In the U.S., the birth rate actually is going back up again, which is great. It's the first time in 2013 that it has risen since 2007. And, you know, a lot has to do with the economy and people feeling better about having families, having maybe children at all or more than one child, just in terms of the economy doing better. In Pittsburgh, last year, about 22,000 babies were born, so that was really good. And the premature birth rate is going down, and that's a great thing, of course. And last year, the numbers that we have are about 450,000 babies are born every year nationwide who are under 37 weeks gestational age. And Pennsylvania has done very well in really reducing that rate and is on pace to surpass the March of Dimes goal, which is to lower the national preterm birth rate to 9.6%, and Pittsburgh is at around 10.7%. So we're doing really well. We are just doing great. Now, this is interesting, Paul. 36% of all women who gave birth last year were not married, and in the metropolitan Pittsburgh area, it was 39%. So we're really looking at a different demographic of people who are having children, and I think we're really embracing that as well.
And, you know, from the business standpoint, what is the impact?
Well, the impact is lots of different products and services that are being developed that aren't what you would have seen in the 50s, 60s, and 70s because we have different needs.
How so? Okay, so what's different?
So there could be different types of products in terms of if you don't have a traditional family, is it a one-parent family? Do you need to have everything take out? I mean, you might not have time for cooking. You're going to have a lot of services to help watch the child. What does that mean in terms of if you're working full-time? So all the things where we made assumptions in the past, a lot of those have changed.
And from home births to maternity wards that resemble spas, there's always some new trend.
Yes.
And years ago, it was whatever book was coming out.
Right.
And I guess Dr. Spock, excuse me, Miss Dr. Spock. Yeah, Dr.
Yes.
Spock. Not to
yes.
be confused with Mr. Spock.
No, let's not do that. He passed.
Yes.
But, right.
Right.
Dr. Spock.
Dr. Spock.
He was sort of
the baby doctor.
Guru. He was the guru, and everybody had a Dr. Spock book, and then it was what to expect when you're expecting. And now there are certainly a number of resources, and there are resources that are available certainly on the internet. But here's a couple of fun things. The Huffington Post gave us the latest on names. So last year, we saw a trend toward picking boy names. Now this year, what's happening is girl names like Alexis are being taken over by boys. There are also a lot of baby names that are referencing the South, like Georgia, Carolina, Alabama. So that's just kind of a
wait a minute.
But,
yes. Hold it right there.
That's great.
There are people actually naming their children Alabama.
Yeah, why not? Come on, work with me here, Paul. That's okay. Let's move on. I mean, it is what it is. I don't know.
What's next? Minnesota, Oregon?
Why not? I like that.
Okay.
Women.
How about people naming their children after fruit, like the
apple,
lead singer from Coldplay,
right.
Gwyneth Paltrow. Apple.
Right?
Come
right.
on. Apple?
I like apple.
Really?
That's nice. Yeah.
Okay.
Come on.
All right.
So women are having babies older, and that's actually been an ongoing trend. this is something that's actually very important, which is soft bedding has been determined by the American Academy of Pediatrics. A new research study came out. It is really dangerous. New babies should not be put around soft bedding. They shouldn't be surrounded by bumpers or pillows. It can lead to suffocation. And babies should be on their backs. When my kids were little, babies were on their tummies. So you see, those kind of things and studies have really changed. And so when you're looking at all the stuff that's in a crib or not in a crib, those things are being taken into account.
It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with our business contributor, Rebecca Harris, about all of the the economics of having a child and trying to fulfill all of the needs of that child, and also what this means for certain businesses in terms of the opportunities for services that they can supply. And whether it's your first child or not, where are expectant parents going to get the baby supplies, be it the stroller or the online advice they need? What are they doing?
Okay, well, first of all, after they have their child on a Wednesday, because it turns out, Paul, that Wednesday is now the most popular day to have your baby. I can't tell you why, but that those are.
Can
the
anybody
ones.
Tell us why?
There are statistics. It's a really fantastic operation. They put all these things together. They, you know, roll them out, and then they have the statistic that more babies are born on Wednesday than any other day.
There could be some choice involved, but not really.
Not really.
But I mean, it's not like you're saying, honey, I really don't want to ruin the weekend. Let's make sure we get this baby out by Wednesday.
And gold bling is the biggest thing in nurseries now. People are embracing all things shiny, and they're picking gold as opposed to pink and blue. They're putting gold shiny things throughout
like
the nursery.
Rockefellers.
Not real gold.
The melons.
All right, moving on.
We've heard about that. You know, there's a reason why they came up with the silver spoon. You're
right,
born with a silver spoon.
This is knockoff gold. Okay. So kidsburg.org is a great resource that you can go to. It's an online resource, a go-to guide from everything from the best places to go with kids to the latest information for parents. We have Pittsburgh Baby Equipment Rental, which is a Pittsburgh store which rents equipment. So that's a great idea. If you don't want to hold on to it, you can rent baby equipment. It's all totally clean and safe, and it's the most up-to-date. And then when you're done, you give it back. I think that's a really interesting concept. There's the Green Cheeks Diaper Service, which has merged with Happy Baby, and they supply organic cloth diaper delivery, cleaning, and pickup in the greater Pittsburgh area. A new trend. We only used to see, you know, the old plastic diapers. So that's
so the green meaning.
Yeah,
yes.
Green. Right. Green.
Got it.
Bravo Babies is a creative experience for parents and babies, and they use music and movement and activities. And Covey, which is it's a new app that was created here locally, helps busy parents to connect and meet each other. And certainly you've heard about 4Moms, Paul, which is in the Strip District, which is a tech-based company focused on creative, innovative products and baby products. They have, for example, a stroller that's based on robotics. You can just touch a button and it opens. It's fabulous.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Now, we're familiar. We've got about a minute left here,
okay.
Rebecca. We're familiar with home shows, car shows, and bridal spectaculars. Are there similar events for parents and babies?
Absolutely. And one of the ones that we really like to recommend and talk about is the Baby and Me programs at the Carnegie Libraries of Pittsburgh. So they're in all the different branches. They're designed for the youngest library users and their parents or caregivers. And during these 20 to 30 minute programs, the babies and their grown-ups actually get exposed to language and books and activities. And it's really nice to do together. And sometimes it's just those wonderful, simple little things that make all the difference.
So when your children have children, will you encourage them to name their child after a state, maybe Pennsylvania?
No, they better name their children after me, Paul.
Oh, there we go.
No, I don't want that. I don't want that. No.
Sure
no,
you don't. She is Rebecca Harris. She's director of the Center for Women's Entrepreneurship at Chatham University, our business contributor. Rebecca, thanks so much. We appreciate
it. It's a pleasure. We have lots of resources on your website, Paul.
Sounds good. Thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. By the way, our website is WESA.FM. That's where you go to hear past segments or shows that you might have missed or even shows you want to revisit, WESA.FM. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.